We will hear first this morning Immigration and Naturalization Service against Finn Pithatia. Mr. Scholder, you may proceed whenever you're ready. Did I pronounce that right, Byron?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The question in this case is whether a deportable alien who first arrived in this country more than 7 years before applying for suspension of deportation can establish physical presence in the United States for a continuous period of 7 years when, during that 7 year period, the alien's illegal presence in this country was interrupted by a 3 month trip abroad, at the conclusion of which the alien knowingly misrepresented her immigration status to secure reentry to the United States. Facts of this case are as follows. Respondent is a native and citizen of Thailand who first arrived in the United States in 1969 as a non-immigrant student, and she was authorized to remain until July 25, 1971. Her husband arrived in this country in 1968, also as a non-immigrant student. He was also authorized to remain until July 1971. Both respondent and her husband remained beyond the July 25, 1971 date. The Immigration and Naturalization Service instituted deportation proceedings in 1977, charging that respondent had overstayed her visa. Respondent conceded deportability, but applied for suspension of deportation under Section 244A1 of the Immigration and Nationality Act. Section 244A1 permits the Attorney General or his delegates to suspend deportation of an alien who shows that he was physically present in the United States for a continuous period of 7 years immediately preceding the application for suspension of deportation, who also shows that he was a person of good moral character during that 7 year period, and who also is able to show that he is a person whose deportation would, in the opinion of the Attorney General, result in extreme hardship to the alien or to certain family members who are U.S. citizens or lawful resident aliens. In this case, respondent admitted that from January 1974 until April 18, 1974, she was absent from the United States when she and her two children took a trip to Thailand to visit her mother. The immigration judge concluded that this absence was meaningfully interruptive of the continuity of respondent's physical presence in the United States. The judge, applying the factors developed by this court in Rosenberg versus Flutie, pointed to several factors. First, the length of the absence, which in this case was 3 months. The fact that respondent obtained travel documents prior to the trip and while she was abroad, this factor tended to demonstrate the deliberateness with which the trip was undertaken and pointed to the fact that respondent had an opportunity to consider the significance of her trip on her immigration status. Finally, the immigration judge noted that respondent knowingly misrepresented her status as the spouse of a non-immigrant student, even though her husband's student visa had expired approximately 2.5 years earlier.
Mr. Scholder, did the service bring any kind of proceeding against the husband?
Yes, it did.
What is the status of that one?
The husband's proceeding is, the service found, the immigration judge found the husband had met the requirements of the statute and was eligible, and I believe the judge found that the husband should be granted relief under the suspension of deportation statute. The Board of Immigration Appeals reversed that, and the board in turn was reversed by the Court of Appeals. So the matter was sent back to the Board of Immigration Appeals for further proceedings. I'm not aware whether any further proceedings have in fact been held with respect to the husband's case.
As far as you know, he too is still in this country.
That's correct.
Mr. Scholder, as long as you're interrupted, what is the status of any reapplication now by the petitioner?
Petitioner reapplied for suspension of deportation before the Board of Immigration Appeals while after this court had granted certiorari, she argued that more than 7 years had elapsed since the 1974 trip and claimed that she was entitled to have her deportation proceedings reopened for a new application for suspension of deportation. That application is still, for a motion to reopen, is still pending before the Board of Immigration Appeals.
And it's your position that that does not make this case moot?
Absolutely.
Because of the discretionary nature.
That's correct,
of that,
Your Honor.
Proceeding.
That's correct. The Board of Immigration Appeals affirmed the immigration judge's decision. In addition to the factors mentioned by the immigration judge, the board pointed out that respondent had overstayed her visa before her trip to Thailand, and she reentered this country by misrepresenting her status. According to the board, the trip therefore substantially increased the likelihood that respondent's illegal status would be discovered and that respondent would be deported. The Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit reversed. The court concluded that the factors enumerated in Flutie were merely evidentiary with respect to the significance of an alien's absence, and that even if an absence increases the risk of an alien's deportation, it cannot be meaningfully interruptive if the hardships associated with that deportation would be equally severe if the absence had not occurred. For the purposes of this case, we accept the application of the test announced in Flutie in the different context of suspension of deportation. Since the Ninth Circuit's decision in Wadman versus INS in 1964, both the courts and the Board of Immigration Appeals have applied the Flutie standards in determining whether an absence by an alien was meaningfully interruptive of the continuity of the alien's physical presence. In other words, we believe...
You said you accept the Flutie standards for the purposes of this case. What does that mean? You have reservations whether you will continue to...
No. No, Your Honor, but just in the... I'm arguing this case in the context of the court's decision and the issues that are...
But you're not suggesting that the...
No.
Agency no longer wants to follow the Flutie standards.
No, Your Honor. In fact, the agency believes that there is room for flexibility in applying the statute. The problem here, however, is that the test created by the Court of Appeals far exceeds any flexibility that was permitted by this Court in Flutie. In fact, it wrenches the Flutie test out of the context in which that test was created, and it produces wholly irrational results, in our view. Flutie, in fact, created a very narrow rule to deal with an exceptional situation where the literal construction of the statute would subject the alien to the sport of chance and meaningless and irrational hazards that were noted in the court's opinion, Flutie. The court relied largely on the analysis of Judge Hand in his decision in DePasquale versus Carnath, and on this court's earlier decision in Delgadillo versus Carmichael.
But Mr. Shulder, is it not also true that the court relied on the comparison to the test of residence, where there can be more substantial interruptions under the residence standard in the Flutie opinion? Did not the court also find support in the notion that residence may be interrupted for purposes of residence for a different purpose?
You're saying the Court of Appeals in this case?
No, I'm talking about the Supreme Court in the Flutie opinion itself. It did not confine its reasoning to the examples you give. It also drew support from the fact that in measuring residence, Congress has allowed substantial interruptions not to interrupt residents.
That's true. The Court's opinion did point to that provision of the Immigration Act.
Right.
Of course, this case involves a separate statute which does not refer to residence, but which refers to physical presence.
Right.
And in fact, the statute had been amended to exclude residence and to insert physical presence into the statute.
Did Flutie involve the same statute?
No, Flutie involved a different provision of the Immigration Act.
But
Flutie,
in your opinion, that makes no difference.
Well, as I said before, since 1964, when the Ninth Circuit applied the same test that had been developed by this court in Flutie to the separate statutory context of the suspension of deportation statute, both the courts and the Board of Immigration Appeals have applied the Flutie standards. As the court, it said in Wadman, the court believed that the word continuous in this statute should no more be read as rigidly as the word intent or not intended in the entry provision of the statute that was at issue in Flutie. And we agree that a certain amount of flexibility is proper under the statute. The flexible construction of the entry provision in Flutie, as the court pointed out in that case, protects a resident alien from the unsuspected risks and unintended consequences of wholly innocent action.
Under the plain language of the statute, where do you find the flexibility?
Well, if the plain language of the statute,
is not flexible, is it?
Certainly would not tend to support a flexible reading.
Is there anything in the legislative history that suggests flexibility?
The only thing in the legislative history that might suggest flexibility is the history of the suspension of deportation statute before the insertion of the particular language at issue here. In other words, the whole notion of suspending deportation was one that was developed by Congress in order to give the Attorney General some discretion to grant relief in cases which previously had only been covered by private bills submitted to Congress.
Is there anything in the legislative history that suggests an absence of congressional intent to provide flexibility?
Yes, there is. There are indications in the legislative history that indicate that Congress meant the statute to be construed quite strictly, if not literally.
And if so, why does the Solicitor General take the position you've stated here?
The reason for our position essentially is that the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is the delegate of the Attorney General and has been administering this statute, has, in a sense, acquiesced in the application of the Flutie standards to this particular statute. We certainly would, as we pointed out in our reply brief, we certainly think that there ought to be room in the statute to cover certain kinds of situations. For example, the situation that was involved in the DePasquale versus Carniff situation, where an alien took an overnight train from Buffalo to Detroit. There was nothing in the record that established that he knew that the train was going to go through Canada during the night. Certainly, there must be, we think, some room in the statute for flexible application. And we think that both the courts and the Board of Immigration Appeals and the immigration judges have been applying the Flutie standards here. They know the contours of the test, and they've been applying it without any major problems until the Ninth Circuit, in this case and in its earlier opinion in Tamyang Patiuth, totally obliterated the
government seek certiorari in the Wadman case?
No, I don't believe so. Under the Flutie test, the question essentially is whether it is reasonable to conclude that the alien should have considered the adverse immigration consequences of a trip abroad. Applying the Flutie factors to this test, we submit that respondent clearly should have considered the adverse implications of her trip. For one thing, the trip itself was quite lengthy. It was 3 months in duration, a substantial period of time, especially when compared to the two-hour trip across the border involved in Flutie. Second, respondent obtained travel documents prior to the trip, evidencing the fact that she had an opportunity to consider the consequences of the trip. Third, respondent had been here illegally for 2.5 years when she left for Thailand. During the trip, she knowingly misrepresented her immigration status to obtain a reentry visa and thereby increased the risk that her illegal status would be discovered.
Mr. Schilder, could I ask one question? These factors, I think, could be relied on by the Attorney General as a matter of discretion to deny suspension, even if you should lose here. I think, is it your position on the eligibility for consideration as a discretionary matter that every 3 months interruption would be sufficient to defeat the continuous president's requirement?
I think it would be the government's position that 3 months is simply too substantial a period of time.
How about 1 month?
Excuse me?
How about 1 month?
Well, as we say in our brief, we don't think that the Flutie test can be establishes bright lines as to what the quantum is.
What's the standard of judicial review?
Standard of judicial.
What? You're asking us to say this is unreasonable?
Well, we're asking the court to apply the test that was established in Flutie
and
to conclude that the test that was created by the Court of Appeals in this case is totally inconsistent with
totally,
the Flutie.
Totally inconsistent.
That's correct.
Because of all of the factors are just
well, because,
3 months.
No, because what the Court of Appeals did here was essentially ignored all of the factors that were enumerated in Flutie and said that even though there was an absence of 3 months, even though there were travel documents obtained, even though there was a misrepresentation about status in order to reenter, so long as the alien can show that there are hardships associated with deportation, then the alien has established continuous physical presence for a 7-year period, even though she was gone for 3 months. We think that that simply turns Flutie on its head.
What would you say about a 3-month absence, which was explained by the individual, showing that he became ill on arriving in Thailand and was not permitted by the doctors to leave until he had fully recovered 3 months later? Would that explanation satisfy the government standard?
It would seem to me that that certainly would satisfy the standards of the Immigration Service, because in that situation, the alien simply would have no choice in the matter.
Was there any explanation offered here?
No, there was not. In Respondent's Court of Appeals brief, her attorney claimed that the visit was to that the trip was to visit her sick mother, but there's nothing in the record of the proceedings, the administrative proceedings in this case, that shows that Respondent's mother was ill, or that the illness, if there was any, necessitated or occasioned the trip.
Mr. Shillis, my first hypothetical is that somebody goes to Thailand because her mother is ill, and it develops that her mother has appendicitis, which is over in a week. And that would be okay, I assume.
I would assume so, Your Honor.
Well, suppose it develops that it was a cancer, and it took 3 months. Would that make any difference?
I think it would make a difference. The alien has to consider the point of this whole test is whether the alien should have considered that there would be adverse consequences. This was an alien who had been who had illegally overstayed her visa in this country. She certainly should be charged with knowing that a trip abroad, certainly a lengthy trip abroad.
Would that apply to the 1 week trip to Thailand?
In the case of an alien who had been here illegally,
when
I would say.
You get through with that, I'm going to give you 1 day.
In the case of an alien who has been here illegally and who leaves while the alien is here illegally, I would submit that that alien might very well be found not to have
go to Thailand at all.
I think the alien would not be able to meet the Flutie test. Absolutely, because any alien who's here illegally,
then you just destroy the statute.
That's not true. There are.
Well, you said there's no way.
No. Well, Wadman itself involved an alien who had been here lawfully prior to the trip, and the factors.
But you say the statute does not apply if the alien is here. Is here, having overstayed his time. You're not saying that, are you?
No, I'm not saying that. The question is whether an absence is meaningfully interruptive of the continuity of the alien's physical presence in the country. And
3 months is it. Some people take a vacation for 3 months.
That's correct, but
then you wouldn't consider that an interruption, would you?
I would consider that a disruption in the context of this particular statute. And the question here is whether the court should stretch the meaning of the statute to benefit an alien in respondent's position.
Mr. Schulder, isn't it true that unlike the situation that arose in Flutie where the question is whether an entry was made, which could involve a person, permanent resident, who's lawfully here, isn't it true that by hypothesis under this statute where the consideration of whether to suspend deportation, that there is an illegal presence in every case?
There's not necessarily an illegal presence before the trip. In Wadman, there was not.
But at least it's illegal as of the time of the application to suspend deportation.
In Kamyang Paniuth, again, there was no illegal presence at the time of the trip.
Do all of these hypotheticals that keep pushing you in one direction and then in another suggest that the government would be better off adhering to the strict language of the statute and the legislative history? You would still exercise discretion in the case where the train crossed into Canadian border, but I'm talking now about what judges should do. What standard is there once you leave the statute and the legislative history?
Well, it's true that as soon as you leave the statute, you lose the fellow who goes on the train overnight.
That may well be true if you apply the statute literally.
Perhaps in a court, but...
The point is, though, that the immigration authorities have been applying this test with some success over the years, for almost 20 years.
And here we are.
Well, here we are, but the reason we're here is that the Ninth Circuit totally jettisoned that test.
Mr. Schulder, it is very difficult, though, to understand why you should apply Flutie to a different statute and to an alien who is illegally here, not someone who has permanent resident status. And it's just hard to understand your position at all on this thing.
I agree. Why didn't the government seek certiorari in Wadman?
I have no idea.
There and probably weren't even born then.
I'm not that young, Your Honor. Well, if this court, exercising its responsibility to construe the statute, determines that, in fact, the statute should be applied literally, we will certainly be bound by that interpretation.
Mr. Schulder, isn't it true that in last analysis, the question is whether these decisions shall be made by Congress, by private bills, or by the Attorney General? That, in other words, if you prevail, they still have the remedy they used to have before the statute was enacted.
That's correct. As I was pointing out to the court, the problem with the test that the Court of Appeals adopted here is that even where the immigration authorities show that the alien has taken a substantial trip abroad, has falsified information in order to return, has obtained travel documents, all of these factors are totally ignored so long as the alien can establish that there was no diminution of hardship. In our view, this compresses two separate elements of the statute, the extreme hardship element that the court dealt with in the Wang case and the continuous physical presence element that's involved here into one element. In fact, in respondent's brief at pages 19 and 23, respondent admits, her counsel admits that he cannot come up with any example of a situation where an alien could show extreme hardship but not continuous physical presence under the statute. The upshot of the Court of Appeals approach here is that it essentially converts the continuous physical presence language of the statute into a continuous residence requirement. In our view, the test of the Court of Appeals would not be any different or lead to any different results if the statute simply said residence instead of physical presence. But as I said earlier in response to Justice Stevens's question, Congress inserted the words physically present in the statute in 1952 in place of residence in order to discontinue the lax practices and to discourage abuses that had arisen under the residence standard. In order to give meaning to Congress's action here, we submit that the judgment of the Court of Appeals should be reversed. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Very well. Mr. Greenberg.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Respondent's position, one position in this matter, is that the action at bar is actually moot. The respondent has accumulated 7 years' continuous physical presence in the United States since her return from Thailand in April 1974. Since the filing of this case, therefore, and the respondent's independent qualification on the sole question presented to this Court, namely, did she have the 7 years' continuous presence, we believe that this Court should abate proceedings and wait for a decision from the Board of Immigration Appeals on the pending motion, which has been on file since February of this year. Now, the Board...
Well, Mr. Greenberg, if the statute simply allows discretion in the Attorney General, assuming someone's been continuously present here for that interval of time, to grant relief or not, how can you argue that it's moot? Your argument is really that we should defer to the administrative proceedings and let them decide it because it might become moot, but it certainly isn't moot today, is it?
Well, I believe it can be, Your Honor. The immigration judge in the hearing found respondent eligible for two of the three statutory requirements of Section 244. The respondent was found eligible as having good moral character and as demonstrating extreme hardship, albeit through her daughter's illness. So the hardship was imputed to her through her daughter's illness. And the only issue that the immigration judge did not find for her on, and did find for the husband on all three issues, was did she have the continuous 7 year presence? Now, petitioner's argument is without that, she cannot have any eligibility for 244 relief. We simply say
she met all the qualifications, isn't there a residuum of discretion in the Attorney General whether to apply it or not?
Yes, Your Honor. It would just seem peculiar to me that if she were found eligible at the time of the immigration hearing as to moral character and extreme hardship, and for the fact that she didn't have the 7 years then, but she has it now, I would think it appropriate for the Board to first make a ruling on that rather than...
But you're arguing for a deferral. It isn't technically moot today, is it?
I'm not sure I understand the technical mootness doctrine, Your Honor. I believe that the matter
Let's
could be
moot. Let's just say it's not moot today, is it?
Okay, Your Honor.
Well, but your position would simply allow an alien who can postpone the inevitable for a while to come in at the end by virtue of 7 years' residence, even though 3 or 4 years might have been simply pursuant to fighting something that the alien ultimately loses.
Well, it's our position that the respondent was eligible then at the time of the hearing, but since there was an adverse decision on that one issue and since 7 years has passed, we did not see why the respondent should not get a hearing on that matter prior to coming to this tribunal.
Mr. Greenberg, we've been testing your friend with hypotheticals from 3 months down. You obviously think 3 months is not a serious interruption, but about 4, 5, 6, or 7 months, I'll put the questions all in one. You tell me where the cutoff is.
Listening to that, Mr. Chief Justice, it really goes to the heart of my argument. We do not believe that there can be a purely mechanical test as to 1 day out of the country or 3 weeks out of the country because we're dealing with human beings and everybody
is... Well, we're dealing with 3 months, so let's start there.
All right. Depending upon the totality of circumstances in this case, the immigration judge firstly has to make a decision whether based on the precedent decisions that are used here, the Flutie, the Wadman Doctrine, the Kamhiang Kadayuth Standard announced by the Circuit Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit, making it an individual determination on the totality of circumstances surrounding each of the three elements of Section 244, being the trier of fact, does the immigration judge feel that that person's entry constituted a break in the 7 year period? If you don't have some type of standard like that, what you will have in every immigration court around the United States is second-guessing by immigration judges because nobody has a standard to propound. Now,
well, you say second-guessing by immigration judges. Who do you think the immigration judges are second-guessing?
Each other, in effect, Your Honor, because one judge in one immigration courtroom in one state may feel that a trip involving any travel documents out of the United States constitutes a break, and another immigration judge may not, depending upon the purpose of that trip and the brevity of that trip.
Well, isn't that a very good reason for going back to the statutory language, which we're dealing with, physically present in the United States for a continuous period of not less than 7 years?
It would solve the problem. I agree with Your Honor on that. But I don't think it's the way the government itself, as represented by petitioner, wants the problem solved.
Well, if the question isn't how the government, quote, wants the problem solved, the question is what Congress intended by that statute, isn't it?
Well, respondent here believes that this remedy, it's an extraordinary
remedy.
You
can't answer my last question, whether it doesn't depend on the intent of Congress?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. It depends on the intent of Congress. But the intent that Congress has read, as we read the intent in this particular legislation, Section 244, and despite the revisions that have gone on over the years, is that this is a statute in the nature of an equitable remedy. And historically, equitable remedies are interpreted more liberally. Otherwise, why have them?
What authority do you have for the proposition that this is in the nature of an equitable remedy, as you put it?
Discussions in the administrative reports and the legislative reports about when the bill was drafted and redrafted, Your Honor.
I had thought that the legislative history indicated a desire for a fairly literal interpretation. You don't agree with that?
No, I do agree with you, Your Honor. I believe a fairly literal reading of the statute is fine, but I think the nature of the remedy itself more or less tends to be equitable rather than strictly a law relief.
Why do you think that?
Because it allows for a person who has no other eligibility for permanent residence to show that by their ties to the United States, by their devotion to this country, by their commitments to this country, that they can have the normal laws suspended on their behalf.
Well, that's an argument that one might well make to Congress, but where do you find that Congress has accepted that argument?
I can't speak to that, Your Honor.
I'm not sure you've responded to my question. What about 6 months? If the interruption had been 6 months and unexplained?
Depending upon other factors in the case, Mr. Chief Justice, if other family members were here, if there were a reason for going abroad, if there were certain ties to the United States.
Whose burden is it to show and explain those things?
The alien, Your Honor.
Yes. Did he show that he had an illness while he was abroad, for example, as one reasonable explanation for prolonged absence?
No, Your Honor. No,
well, where would you draw this line?
Where would the line be drawn?
Yes. 6 months, 12 months?
Our basic approach, Your Honor, is that we cannot draw the line, that a test on this particular issue has to be a test of totality of circumstances, and that there is no better way to draw the line than to say to the immigration judge and to the Board of Immigration Appeals, you must look at the factors in each case and make an independent decision. But look at each factor of the statute independently.
The government has conceded, if I understood the Solicitor General's office correctly, that if an explanation could be made that the man was ill and could not return, that would be satisfactory. But what explanation was offered here?
In our case, Your Honor, none. In fact, there is an error which the counsel has alluded to. There was an error in the transcript. Not an error in the transcript. There was an error done in the brief, in our brief, indicating that the trip abroad was to visit her sick mother. There was no evidence at the hearing that she was a sick mother. It was picked up, and it was never corrected, and we apologize to the court for that. The female respondent merely stated that she was going to Thailand to visit her mother. What our basic argument is that...
Well, do I understand that if the absence were 2 years, you would not be here?
once again, if we apply this type of test, a totality of circumstance test, which we feel is applied in other areas of law, which is a logical extension of the Flutie-Waldman doctrine, that the immigration judge can look at the factors involved and make a decision whether the absence was interruptive of the 7-year period, but to hang it on a merely mechanical 3 days or 30 days does not seem appropriate.
Or 2 years.
Or 2 years. That's correct.
What do you give to the unexplained? I could consider a 1 month unexplained absence from the country being bad, and a 2-year explained absence not being bad, couldn't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
And we don't have that in this case because there was no explanation.
That's correct.
Well, what do you do with that?
You go back to the actual trial judge who was the trier of fact on the spot, and look at what he decided as to the cause or sufficiency of the absence.
He, quote, explained, end quote.
No, there was no explanation on the record.
Did he go outside the record in his explanation?
No, Your Honor.
I have problems on the non-explanation point. And you haven't helped me yet. Can you go? Can you give me some help?
I haven't helped you, no, Your Honor.
Well, it was a record that she went to visit her mother.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. But there was no language in the transcript about visiting a sick mother.
No, I understand. But nevertheless, the explanation was she went to visit her mother.
That's correct.
Well, I know it's outside the record, but why didn't you say that?
I hope it was the truth, Your Honor. The petitioner herein has cited and has stated for the court that the other circuits in their brief have stated that other circuit courts around the United States have felt compelled not to follow the Ninth Circuit's reasoning in the Kam Hiang Patiyuk test, and in fact have criticized that test as being too broad and destroying any standard that we have. We disagree on that. We believe that other cases from other circuits are basically using the same test of a totality of circumstances, but are just saying it in different ways, are just interpreting it in different ways. For example, the recent 11th Circuit case of 1983, Fidalgo Velez versus the Immigration Service, it was held in that case that a one-day trip to Canada where the alien proceeded to obtain an immigrant visa, knowing that her husband had died, who in fact, that was the eligibility for getting the immigrant visa through her citizen husband, broke the 7-year period for residence. Now, that's a one-day trip abroad. We have no problem with that. An alien who leaves the United States under compulsion, and one of the cases that we have indicates leaving the United States under compulsion, one day abroad, breaks the 7-year period. This type of case, we believe the Ninth Circuit could make a finding that there is a break in the 7-year residence here. The petitioner argues that a strict interpretation argues basically for a strict interpretation of Section 244, but concedes that the Flutie-Waldman doctrine applies. There was no appeal filed on Kam Hiang Patiyuk, so we really have an inconsistent position that we are faced with constantly as members of the immigration bar in trying to decide, is it a strict standard or is it a liberal standard? We believe the remedy to that is to allow the immigration judges wide latitude in making their decision. Now, if the immigration judge does that and the Board of Immigration Appeals, if there is an appeal filed by either side, makes an independent determination, I don't believe we'll be in a situation where We've been criticized for trying to go around the Wang decision decided by this court.
Where the Court of Appeals test in this case with the Flutie factors?
Flutie mentioned several factors involved in an entry statute. Flutie did not say these are the only factors involved. Flutie said that there may be, by judicial inference or by other reading into, other factors may be read into it that can be used in determining whether entry was made. And they said,
what would you say if the factors mentioned in Flutie were exclusive? What if those were the only factors? Wouldn't the Ninth Circuit's test be inconsistent with that then? They seem to feel compelled to say that the Flutie factors were only some evidence, and you could look at other evidence.
Yes,
so what if you were confined to the Flutie factors here?
With Flutie alone, without Wadman?
Mm-hmm.
I think that you would...
Well, no, not with... No, Wadman just applied the Flutie factors to in this context.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the Ninth Circuit here said the Flutie factors and the Wadman factors were just evidentiary.
Yes.
And came up with this test.
Yes.
Now, what if the Flutie factors were the only factors you should look at?
You would still have some latitude on the part of the immigration judges to say what is casual, what is innocent.
My question is, would the Ninth Circuit's judgment in this case would be wrong, wouldn't it, under the Flutie factors?
If I understand, Your Honor, correctly, if there were no latitude in the Ninth Circuit to interpolate other factors into that Flutie decision, or even to say what the factors in the Flutie decision really are, yes, I think that they would be bound by that.
Well, certainly Flutie didn't suggest that just because the hardship remained the same, there could be relief. That isn't what Flutie said. It isn't what Wadman said either, is it?
No, it was a taking off point for how to interpret in Wadman, how to interpret a statute that does not seem to, on the literal reading of it, permit anything to be read into it that is not there on the printed page.
Mr. Greenberg, while you're interrupted, I think I asked your opponent, the real question is whether Congress or the Attorney General shall decide questions like this. You do still have a remedy by way of private bill in Congress, don't you?
Well, the private bill remedy, Your Honor, is practically an academic issue today because of Rule 6 in the House, and very few private bills are the old benefit of the private bill, where they would be introduced and they would sit during two sessions of Congress, does not happen realistically anymore. When they are introduced, they get voted on quite quickly. So the private bill is really not a solution here.
This is the same statute that was involved in the Chadha case, isn't it?
Correct, Your Honor.
That case doesn't really shed any light on our problem, does it?
There is one analogous issue in that case. In 1980, Chadha became married to a U.S. citizen and had alternate relief, 245 relief for adjustment of status. What we're saying here is our respondent has the same relief, no difference, no other eligibility, no 245 relief. 244 relief, that she had it then, that the petitioner said she didn't have it then because she didn't have it 7 years, but she's got it now. So whether you look at it for the first view or the second view of it, she has eligibility now.
Let me go back to you say that the congressional remedy is no longer available. How long has it been true that there really is no congressional remedy? Because as I understand the background of this statute, its purpose was to turn over a group of decisions to the Attorney General that Congress had previously been making.
Mm-hmm.
Did they immediately change their rules and so that there no longer was a remedy, such as you say there isn't now?
No, Your Honor. With respect to private bills, if memory serves, it was sometime in the late 1970s that Rule 6 was introduced in the House, requiring members of the Judiciary Committee and the Immigration Subcommittee to decide whether or not a private bill should be allowed to be introduced on the floor. As a result of that, very few private bills ever get through the House. In the Senate, there is no limitation on introducing private bills. However, The few that I've seen in the Senate have been called up and voted on very quickly. One was within 90 days of introduction, whereas prior to that, prior to the Immigration Service's complaints about private bills, they would sit for two sessions of Congress as more or less a courtesy to the congressman or senator who introduced it. But that is not the case anymore.
I
don't think many practicing immigration lawyers rely on private bills to assist them with their clients.
Well, the thought that was running through my mind is that maybe a strict construction would be very appropriate if there is a congressional remedy, as there had been in the past. But if there's no longer a congressional remedy available, perhaps the statute should be construed a little differently. That's the problem I'm wrestling with.
I understand, Your Honor.
May I ask whether there was a quota on immigration from Thailand at the time of this case?
Yes, there was, Your Honor.
And were they Thai citizens awaiting their turn to come into the United States under that quota?
Were these particular people the respondents here?
From,
no.
From Thailand, not,
yes,
not these people. But there were Thai people awaiting their turn to come into the United States lawfully.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And was it not the intention of Congress to protect the interest of people who were operating in accordance with the laws of the United States primarily, rather than people who were deportable, who had disobeyed our laws?
I believe so, Your Honor. My last point is simply that the petitioner herein in their brief and in their argument is seeking to do basically what they're accusing respondent of collapsing two of the three elements of Section 244 into each other, and in effect saying that if the immigration judge finds hardship, don't worry so much about 7 years and don't worry so much about good moral character. Respondent's position is that is not the situation at all, that the respondent believes that each factor of Section 244 shall be independently determined by the immigration judge. In fact, in this case, the immigration judge first made a finding on hardship before he even looked at the issue of 7 years residence or good moral character. In summation, we believe that the standards set forth by the Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit, describing a totality of circumstances test for adjudicating Section 244, is fairer. And we do believe that the case is moot at this point, and there is a proper relief before the Board of Immigration Appeals with the pending motion. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Schulder?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...